Basically, speaking about forms of mindfulness, forms of that mysterious, apparently simple quality of mind that lies at the heart of meditation and that lies at the heart of any transformative process. I've mostly spoken in psychological terms yesterday, but those of you with some familiarity with Buddhist teachings will have with ease recognized a number of bits we could refer to in Pali who come straight out of Buddhist psychology. I'd like to basically continue that investigation. The premise of yesterday was that growth, spiritual growth, psychological growth, any growth whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned, is relational. It happens within the context of relationship. Relationships not just with other people, but also with our own experience. Our capacity for that relationship with our own experience is likely to be mirrored in our capacity for relationship with other people and vice versa. If we are capable of handling other people, generally we have a greater vocabulary in relating to our own experience. This doesn't always translate one-to-one. Yeah? So I may be capable of be very useful to other people and at the same time studiously avoid relating to my own helplessness regarding myself. Yeah? Sometimes this is exactly what happens. We get really good at helping others in what we're completely clueless at helping ourselves with. Yeah? So there are many ways of doing this, but there is a correlation between my capacity to relate to my own experience, the fluidity I have in that, the attunement I have in that, the sensitivity I have in that, the willingness I have in that, and what's happening in my relationship with other people. If I can't handle my own fears, I am unlikely to handle anybody else's fears very well. Yeah? If I can't feel what's going on in my own mind, in my own heart, in my own body, I am probably not very astute in what's going on in other people's minds, other people's hearts, other people's bodies. Yeah? So there are correlations in that. This is not an absolute truth, but there is a kind of sort of received wisdom that sensitivity to a particular area of my experience makes me probably more sensitive to that area in somebody else's life. So that's a premise that basically leads us to acknowledge that what we do to understand this heart, this mind, this psychological functioning more deeply, that probably deepens our capacity for relating to these processes in other people. In other words, when I learn to become more mindful of my own life, more attuned to what's taking place in my own experience, I am likely to be able to use that capacity for other people as well. That means it takes away the dichotomy of practicing for oneself or practicing for others. You may recognize this is a beautiful little story coming. Let me tell you that story. It's unplanned, so I don't have it off the cuff. It's in the Satipatthana Samyutta. It's a famous little story for those of you who know the Satipatthana teachings, the teachings on the cultivation of presence of mind. And the teaching focuses on a little girl called Frying Pan. She has the unflattering name Frying Pan. We do not know. We have to reconstruct that little story from the commentaries. And we assume that the little girl is about 10 years old and it's part of an athletic team. So the athletic team consists of Master. Master is a grown-up male who works with a bamboo pole. And it consists of Medakatalika, that's a little frying pan, who climbs upon that bamboo pole, which probably is balanced either here on the chest bone or on the forehead of the man. And the two play tricks and get money that way, so they do. He balances the pole, she climbs on him and then onto the pole, and then I gather she flattens herself at the top of the pole somehow. That's probably where the image of the frying pan comes from. So, the Buddha relates the story of these two, and he says, once upon a time, there was this bamboo acrobat with his little assistant called Medakatalika, and he said to her, you take care of me, and I take care of you, and together we play tricks. You climb the pole, you do what you do there, and you come down safely, and we get the money, and we're both looked after, one by the other. Yeah? So, I look after you, you look after me, so we're both looked after, and we're safe that way. And then there's the unexpected turn of the history, the story. The little girl disagrees with master. You know, it's unusual for little assistants to disagree with masters. It's even more unusual for little girls to disagree with masters, as you can surmise. So then the girl says, no, this is not how it works. I tell you how it works. I look after myself, you look after yourself. This way we both are looked after, and we're safe. Yeah. So the Buddha explicitly agrees with the girl. Says this is the story he tells his monks. So he agrees with the girls and says, this is the right procedure. You know, I look after myself, and you look after yourself, and in this way we're both looked after and are safe. And after having agreed with the little girl, going counter to the master statement, he then turns the thing around and says, it is by looking after oneself that one looks after others. It is by looking after others that one looks after oneself. So initially he disagrees with the master, sides with the girl, who says the contrary of the master. And then he does a kind of dialectical twist and says, although she is right and it's necessary to look after yourself and that you look after yourself, actually by looking after oneself one looks after others. By looking after others, one looks after oneself. And then he proceeds to say, how does one look after oneself? By looking after others. No, how does one look after others by looking after oneself? This is, first of all, by practice, by repeated effort, and by dedication. Yeah? So by applying oneself to something. That's how one looks after oneself. That's how one looks after others, by looking after oneself. And how does one look after oneself by looking after others? It is through patience. It is through metta, through loving kindness. It is through sympathy. No, not sympathy is the word. Empathetic resonance, that's the word. Anudayata. Yeah. It's an old word for compassion. And through nonviolence. That is how one looks after oneself, by looking after others. Patience, loving kindness, empathy, and non-violence. Yeah. So, coming back to my point, the acknowledgement that the capacity to relate to my own experience is deepening my capacity to relate to others in relationship is a profound acknowledgement of non-separativeness. A major tenet in Buddhist teaching, you know, that my happiness cannot be complete without including your happiness. Yeah. That however individualized, however isolated, however solidified in my psychological contours I may feel, actually I am deeply connected, not just to the people to the left and to the right of me, but actually to that whole world, to that whole planet. Yeah. One of the strange things that has happened with Buddhist teachings here in the West is a certain... some terms have taken on an own life, yeah, their own life. Yeah. One of these terms is the term meditation. It's a very weird word. If you look at the Buddhist term, it's called bhavana, and that means cultivation, it means development, it means bringing into being. Literally. And that term has four major branches. One of them is the branch dealing with bodily experience, this body's experience, and my connection to other bodies, and ultimately to the body of planet Earth. Yeah, this whole domain called Kaya Bhavana generally falls outside of our notion of meditation. The second section is about my relationship to the social world. It's called Sila Bhavana. Generally also falls outside of Western notions of meditation. The third section of Bhavana, now we're getting a little closer to what we sometimes mean by meditation, is Chitta Bhavana. It means the stilling of mind, primarily the capacity to down-regulate that mind in its activity, to make it more quiet. And the one branch of this Chitta Bhavana is the cultivation of the four Brahma Viharas, of the four forms of universal empathy, loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. These are, by the way, relational aspects. These are not meditational states. These are things to be practicing with other human beings, including oneself. These are not particularly abstract meditative attainments. These are attitudes. And deep down, they are fundamental and intrinsic qualities of the human heart. So Chitta Bhavana, stilling the mind and developing universal forms of empathy. And finally, Panya Bhavana, the development of understanding. Now the Western word meditation doesn't really, in my mind, cover these four areas very aptly. If I, I'm not a native English speaker, as you have surmised, so don't trust me on this, but it doesn't somehow sound like the root of the word meditation coming from Latin meditare, meaning thinking deeply, somehow doesn't cover, in my understanding, the range of these four forms of bhavana. So why that term meditation was chosen to translate these forms of cultivation, I do not know. I do not know the history of this, and I don't understand it. But meditation is more than thinking deeply, as I hope you're aware of, and it's probably even more than sitting on one's cushion trying to become more still. If you think of these four areas of cultivation, then you realize that they cover much of our lives. They not just cover stress management or the amelioration of our nocturnal cortisol production or something like that. It's obviously a vision of growth in the area to the physical relationship from this body to its planet, social relationship to all other human beings, a vision of what the mind could develop into in terms of the four immeasurable states of mind, the four forms of universal empathy, and finally, the development of insight in how this all works. So this is a big program. And somehow the English word meditation seems to be selling that program a little bit short. It's not a particularly English problem. The French or the Germans are no better than that one. They use the same word. And the same reductionism applies there. So it somehow seems to be a Western kink in the reception of Buddhist teachings. Other things get kind of blown out of proportion. The notion of mindfulness suddenly becomes the panacea for all evils in the world, which it is not in Buddhist teaching, I have to tell you. While it is totally important, and I hope to say more about some of its images today, it actually is never considered the sole panacea for resolving the ills of the world. Mindfulness, however appreciated and given prime importance by the Buddha, was always a team player. It was never promised to fix anger or to fix pain or to fix thought or to fix emotion or to fix unhappiness. It was considered to be indispensable in the fixing of these things, but it was not considered to be doing it alone. It was considered to be part of a set of qualities of mind that bring about these transformations. But back to the relationship bit. Where does that leave you? We know from relationship that they basically hinge on two major functions of mind. One of them is interest. It's our willingness it's our approval that this is happening. I said yesterday that I still find it a remarkable phrase I've learned in English, which says, we're not having this conversation, as a statement to about life or about things happening in our life. And relationship means we are having this conversation. Yeah? Even if I do not like that kind of conversation, and even if I don't like where you are, relationships is yes, we are having this conversation. Yeah. So, interest, approval that this is happening. Yes, I don't like the subject of that conversation, but we are having the conversation. Yeah. That, as a firm statement, is one of the bases of relationship. If you want to do diplomacy, the first statement is, your right to exist is okay. I'm not going to put that into question, okay? Yeah. If you want to do diplomacy, that's the first statement, you say. I completely concede with your presence. Yeah. I completely allow you coexistence in my world. Yeah. I'm not trying to get you out here. I'm not trying to chase you back into the oceans or I don't impose that you become different before I start relating to you or something like that. So first statements in relationship, as in diplomacy, is acceptance. This is easily said. It's not so easily done. Yeah. I accept you and then you change, okay? Or I accept you a little bit and then you change a lot, you know, on my terms. So, to come to an unconditional yes for what is happening generally takes a little bit of work in any area of your life, basically. Meditation is no different in this. And that brings us to the second part, that is, with the interest, with the intention, comes the attention, both the willingness and the capacity to attend to something in a way that is attuned, that is resonant, and that is effective. These are psychological terms, but obviously that's right there in Buddhist teaching. You know, you have to meet it. If you want to transform it, if you want to understand it, if you want to transform it, if you want to liberate it, you have to meet it first. You can't liberate things that you haven't met, haven't understood, and haven't transformed. It's very simple. The sequence is clear. You say hello before you find out where they're coming from. Before you find out what they can do for you or what you can do for them, you shake their hands, you look into their eyes, you ask after their families, yeah? You sit them down and you make sure that they have something to eat or to drink. This applies for meditation. So we sit down, we meet, we connect with, we get in touch, we find out. These are all very simple moves of intention and attention. If you want to break that down psychologically, it means you acknowledge what's here, you orient towards, you show interest, you are welcoming that, and then you create availability, and then you resonate. Then you connect with this, and then you stay in touch with it. Yeah? We know that. We all know that. We've all grown out of relationship. You all have a mother. I would suspect most of you will have a father. You will have siblings. You will have friends. So we all know something about that already. This is not entirely new. Meditation is not entirely new. And if we look at this psychologically, then there is a whole sequence of steps that take place when we get to know something or somebody. Now, that's not different for our own experience. And the capacity in which we can hang in there generally deepens our connection. The magic in mindfulness does not come with topical and episodical moments of great awareness. It comes with sustained and continual relationship. That's where the magic kicks in. We're all topically aware. We're all topically mindful. For the nice bit, for the indispensable bit, for the urgent bit, for the sudden bit, for the powerful bit. But staying with things, yeah? As in staying with relationship, is what really reveals depth. It's what reveals the potential that's in something. So we need to learn to stay with things. If we train attention, basically there's two simple ways in which it can be trained. One of them is it can be trained temporally, meaning we're more capable of staying with something for duration. Yeah? An event in our experience, and we learn to follow that event. Yeah? Longer than just the moment where it, you know, where it climaxes and then goes over the hump, but then we still stay with it. Yeah? So that's one way of training. Training in time, training in duration, training in continuity of staying with something. The other way we can train attention is spatially. Yeah? The metaphor here is obviously things happening parallel at the same time, and we can hold a field of attention. Rather than just follow an object in its process and its changes, we actually hold a field of attention, and in that field, things emerge and things disband, and the field does not collapse. Yeah? So our attention becomes object independent. While in the first case of temporal attention, attention is object dependent. It follows that object in its changes. And the second type of attention is a field type of attention, and the field does not collapse onto the object that emerges and disappears. So let's translate that into a meditative experience. If we sit down, if you don't have any meditative experience, your mind will just go wherever it likes. Yeah, it hurts a little here, so your mind will go here. You hear a sound out there, your mind will go out there. That sound makes you remember something, so you will hover with your memory for a moment. The memory fades, then you will feel something else in your body, you will go there. Then you will think of something that your body feeling made you aware of. Then you plan something, and so forth. Yeah? No anchor, no continuity. You will just go to the dominant experience. There's a montage technique in filmmaking. Yeah, it's kind of montaging your cuts on the dominant. That means if, you know, protagonist A walks through the field, and then you have a cut, and then you have another shot, and then protagonist A still walks somewhere. Yeah, you see him from another angle. So you just keep, if this type of attention is working, you just keep fishing out the dominant sensory experience in your six fields of experience. Whatever comes up, whatever hits your system is likely to get the attention. So no anchor, no direction, no continuity. The only continuity is seeking the most dominant experience. Yeah. That's what we often do. It's not something unusual. It's the default mechanism of our mind. Second type of attention is when we have decided that we actually want to focus on something. There is a deliberate choice on a object, a particular sequence of events, a particular area of attention. Yeah? Still, we get pulled off that object. We want to think that thought to the end. We want to follow that melody. We want to stay with the breath. We want to, chop that garlic. Yeah? That would be the object. And we kind of keep doing that. And then we get pulled off of it, you know, while chopping the garlic, I kind of listen to the news. Yeah, so we get pulled off of that. While trying to stay with the breath, I think of my next holidays. Yeah, so I have chosen an object and an anchor, and then my attention gets pulled off of this time and again. Pulled off, and I come back and get pulled off. Come back, get pulled off. That'd be the second quality type of attention. Third stage we could call, attention is staying with the object. There's still a pull. Yeah, thoughts are there. Sensory impact is there. There's still a pull that I'm losing my object, but I am more or less staying with it. Yeah, I'm more or less staying with the breath, more or less staying with the garlic, more or less staying with the melody. Yeah, but I'm still having other kinds of experiences that seem to appeal to me to do something else with my attention than staying with the chosen object. You'll recognize that. I have no doubt you have all experienced this. You probably wouldn't be here if you hadn't experienced this. Yeah. Now, fourth stage of attention, that's where attention really starts becoming mindfulness. Attention starts now having had a fluid quality. And that fluid quality enables that the space around the object grows bigger. Yeah? So we have a space, and in that space, objects arise and object sees, and the attention field does no longer collapse. Yeah? The field itself, the attentional field, has a stability so that the objects that arise in it do not, when they cease, take the attention away. Yeah? The field is stable enough to actually acknowledge and witness the arising and the ceasing of events in this field. So you notice that there is enough stability in your attentional field that thoughts arising and thoughts ceasing without taking your attention away with the train of thought, for example. So that's where things start getting interesting. That's where meditation really starts kicking in. The stabilizing of that field obviously will deepen the sense of stillness of mind, and then some very useful and fascinating things start happening. So consider, if we translate the qualities of relationship into these little stages, you'll see that it is necessary to basically identify where do I give my attention and what do I want to do. Attention is finite, as I claimed yesterday, and I continue to claim that today. It means if it's finite, we need to make choices. Because it's finite, we don't can give our attention to everything. It would be nice if we could evenly spread kind of panoramic sati all around. No time constraints, no constraints of attentional focus. But we don't. Everybody knows if you want to deepen one thing, you have to give up many, many other things in favor of that one thing. Simple, isn't it? Attention, William James already noted that 100 years ago, 120 years ago. Attention consists of retrieving one's attention from some things to be able to deepen it for other things. There is an intrinsic act of renunciation. This is highly unpopular, but here it is. Yeah? You cannot deepen something without sacrificing something. Renunciation is absolutely inevitable. Any yes you say entails not just what you want to say yes to, but how willing you are to say no to other things. Being here means you're going to miss an awful lot of things. I'm sure there's some boat racing out there on the Thames somewhere. And I'm sure you could walk on the heath, you could drive down to the coast, you could go sailing, canoeing, kayaking, God knows what. You could do many, many things. And you're going to miss out on all this, for sitting here. There's a huge life out there which you're going to miss out for the whole day. Probably the last lovely day of that summer. There's great guys out there making fantastic music, sports folk out there. All of this you're going to miss. Worse, you haven't been shoehorned into this. You've chosen this. It's your responsibility. You can't even blame it on me. If I let you down and disappoint you and bore you, you know who's to blame. It's not me. It's you who made that decision. You could have read up on my case. It'd be easy enough, You now know what you've gotten yourself in for. Boring Buddhist tells me old stuff I already know. So we all know that, yeah? If I say I marry you, and I marry you, and I marry you, and I marry you, and I marry you, it doesn't really mean a lot. Yeah? My yes to something, some value, some person, is only as good as I'm willing to say no to a few other people, to a few other options. So we all know this. That's not different from meditation. And that's not easy because we have choices, many more choices. And these choices are not all conscious. So generally, once the choices become conscious, things get a lot more easy. It's not sweet, but it's a lot more easy. The challenge is where the choices take place. If the choices take place within my conditioning and in a sort of pre-conscious way, then what makes the choice is not my it's not the best of my parts. It's basically my conditioning that makes the choice. It's either the pleasure-seeking mind or the discomfort-avoiding mind. You know, these two guys, they do the majority of my choosing in a pre-conscious way. Before it gets deliberate, there is an intrinsic seeking of pleasure, comfort, agreeable conditions. If you do not believe me that, you will need to verify this in your own experience. Much of where our attention goes is basically decided by the simple wishing to give myself a pleasant experience and to avoid unpleasant experiences. As long as these two factors are the deciding forces where my attention goes, it's very difficult to cultivate attention. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, there's so much emphasis on learning to stabilize an attentional focus on a chosen object. In many meditative schools, Buddhists particularly are emphatic. So let's do some of this. Take up a good sitting posture.